So,
first I was just wondering if you could just kind of describe the process that went behind starting the Rime Center, why you decided to start it, and particularly what went behind choosing the location of it. Because I know you live, well, you know, further south than here, and the Rime Center is in downtown Kansas City.
It's a 30-mile trip each way. It's a 60-mile round trip.
Sure.
Well, I became involved in Buddhism in the late 80s, early 90s, and there was there are different forms of Buddhism, as you know, and this group that I became affiliated with practiced Tibetan Buddhism, and I just felt a real connection to that. But the group itself was very sectarian, really sectarian, you know, and there's kind of a history of that historically in Tibetan Buddhism, that there are four lineages. There's Nyingma, there's Kagyu, there's Gelupa, and there's Sakya. And it's almost like denominations in Christianity. Mm-hmm. And historically, one would have nothing to do with the other. They might be sitting side by side, and they would have nothing to share teachers, teaching, and anything like that. So some very wise teachers back in the 1800s said, well, this is really stupid. We need to get together. And so there's this, it's actually a Tibetan term, Rime, spelled R-I-M-E, that encourages this non-sectarian form of Buddhism. It's something the Dalai Lama promotes very much. It's spelled R-I-M-E, but it's pronounced Rime, R-E-E-M-A-Y is how I write it phonetically. It looks like Reem, but I think we need a little accent above the E, I think, to do it properly.
Sure.
So, in about 1995, I told my wife, I said, you know, I didn't feel like this, it was quite the right fit for me, this Buddhist group. I said, I think there's room in Kansas City for a non-sectarian Buddhist group. So in 1995, and this is our 20th year, we're having a big 20th year anniversary in July, you're invited.
What's the actual date on that?
It's Saturday, July 25th. It starts at 4:30. And it's also kind of my retirement party, because I'm retiring at the end of the
year. Oh, you're retiring.
Yeah. So in 1995, we began very humbly. We rented some space at the Roland Park Community Center. Are you familiar with that?
I am, yeah.
It was formerly an elementary school. So what we had was essentially a classroom. It didn't have great ambience. It was a linoleum floor and, you know, just like an empty classroom. We'd haul cushions in, you know, the trunk of my car. I had a portable shrine. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of work, and I sent out some emails, and you know, we do this every Wednesday. I can't remember, it was Wednesday or Thursday night. And some weeks nobody showed up. Some weeks two people showed up. You know, if we had five people show up, that was like a big deal. And so we continued to meet there for about 2 years, and then the Shambhala Center that I was part of, they were having some internal difficulties, some internal fighting, and people were leaving. But they had a building that they, I guess owned is the right word. They were paying, had a mortgage on it, so they were buying it.
Yeah.
And they were having trouble meeting their bills, and so I suggested to them that we meet there one day a week. And you got to realize this was 25 years ago, we'd pay them $100 a month. And they said, great. I mean, they needed the money, you know. So we met there one day a week. Like I say, remember, this was 25 years ago. So that would probably be more like $150 or $200 today. And so it was great because, you know, it had a wonderful ambience. They had meditation cushions like at the Rime Center. They had a shrine set up. And we didn't have to bring all the stuff, set it up, you know. It was a very nice environment. And so we met there for the next couple of years, and we started doing more programming, and the more we kind of grew, the more they diminished just from internal conflict, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we brought some Tibetan teachers over, and we did programs, we did retreats there, and finally, after about 2 years, they asked us to leave. And I was devastated, because my first thought was, oh my God, I don't want to go back to the Woodland Park Community Center. And they were upset because people were beginning to identify that building with us more than with them. So they just said, there was like no negotiation. It was just like, we got to find another place. So, So I started looking around, looked at some buildings that were for rent. I was familiar with the building we're in now, and I was coming off the highway in that exit and had a big for lease sign on it. Well, for 20 years, City in Motion, dance company, I don't know if you're familiar with them,
yeah.
But they had been there for 20 years. That was at a rehearsal space. They rented it. And the Shrine Room had a ballet bar on one side. One side we have curtains against the solid wall.
Mm-hmm.
Behind those, it's all mirror.
For dancers.
Yeah, so we're just covering it up. You know? So I called the number and I asked about the rent, and it was way beyond our means, you know. We had maybe 7 or 8 regular members at that time. And I said, thank you very much. And they called the guy back again. I said, you know, we might be in a better position to buy the building than to rent it. Would you consider selling it to us? And he said, well, what is it you want to do? So I told him, and he said, oh, well, that's really interesting. Why don't we have a meeting, lunch meeting next week with my partner? I'll rent the building again. So I did, and they loved the idea of turning it back, using it for spiritual space, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So they rented it to us way below market value. They had a falling out with City in Motion, so they had been kind of evicted. So we turned around and sublet it back to City in Motion on the nights we weren't using it, and really that helped pay the rent. We couldn't have afforded it otherwise. But after 2 years, we had grown to the size that we were now sustainable. They found their own place, they moved out, and so it was like the perfect storm or karma or whatever. I mean, everything came together, and one of my board members just thought I was completely nuts, I'd lost my mind. We got 6 or 8 members, and you're moving into a 14,000 square foot building?
Yeah.
He just shook his head, you know?
Yeah.
And here we are 20 years later, and
More members than that.
We have
now
400 members, and lots of programming.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's what, you know, it was really, and I think often new religions start or branches of religion start because of dissatisfaction with the status quo, you know?
Sure.
And
yeah.
That's why we have Presbyterian and we have Methodist, we have, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. You mentioned, so you already kind of touched on this a little bit, about your kind of interest in Tibetan Buddhism specifically. So I guess I was wondering what specifically about the Tibetan tradition drew you to it. Did you have experience early on with other forms of Buddhism? And yeah, if so, why Tibetan Buddhism?
Well, my only former experience was with the Shambhala Center, which practiced Tibetan Buddhism. And Tibetan Buddhism has the most ritual associated with it. Like, if you asked in Christianity which denomination has the most ritual, people would probably identify Catholicism. And the same in Buddhism. If you said which school of Buddhism has the most ritual, I mean, no doubt it's Tibetan Buddhism. Very rich with ritual. Now, some people like ritual, as I do. Some people don't like ritual, you know. I personally like it. I think it can be very meaningful. It can help you actualize things that you want to achieve, you know. Did that answer?
Yeah, sure. So, part of my studies at KU, and I guess part of my emphasis in this project is ritual practice and observing the various, specifically meditation, and like looking at different forms of meditation and how it differs between traditions. So, I listened to your meditation instructions that I found online, and so I kind of wanted to talk about that a little bit. My first question is, you mentioned that you meditate with your eyes open. So, what's the significance of that? Why do you...
Well, what I was always taught is that, I personally don't think it matters a great deal.
Okay.
I think meditating with your eyes closed, I find, you know, the goal of meditation is to follow your breath. Keep your focus of attention on your breath.
Mm-hmm.
If I close my eyes, then I start seeing visual images, and I'm much more easily lost in discursive thinking, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that's one reason I meditate with my eyes open. But the reason I was given by my meditation instructor is that when we meditate from the Tibetan perspective, that we're not escaping from the world when we meditate. We're still fully engaged in the world even when we meditate. Therefore, we meditate with our eyes open.
Mm-hmm. Which, that's very interesting, because a lot of people view meditation as perhaps an attachment as opposed to an engagement.
Or an escape from the world, right?
Sure, yeah. So the idea of meditation as an engagement is one. Are there any other things about Tibetan meditation practice specifically that you think is unique to the Tibetan tradition?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. We have higher practices, specifically two of them that are higher types of meditation practice. One is called the Dzogchen. It's spelled D, the D is silent. D-Z-O-G-C-H-E-N. So it's pronounced Dzogchen.
Okay.
The D is silent. And the other is Mahamudra, and it's M-A-H-A, Maha, and then Mudra, M-U-D-R-A. They're very, very similar. Essentially the same. They come from two different lineages, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But they're very, very high practices. And they're types. Some would say they're not even a type of meditation, but they are. You know?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We have a female lama coming this month,
mm-hmm.
the last weekend of June. And it's kind of unusual, a female lama. Her name's Lama Lina. And previously, her Tibetan teacher from Sopema, India, would come every year, year after year, and give these wonderful teachings on Dzogchen. And he's just very elderly now, and so now he sends his senior disciple. She's about my age, and she teaches literally all over the world, goes to centers that he used to go to. And
when is she going to be in town?
The last weekend, I can look it up here, last weekend of June. And that would be... like the 28th,
26th, 27th,
28th.
Okay.
6, 20. And you're welcome to attend. And we've kind of changed our policy. You know, we used to have, we still do have fees, suggested fees, but now we're saying anybody can come, anybody can pay anything they want. If they don't have anything, come anyway, you know?
Sure.
If you can afford more, pay more, and you cover for somebody that can't pay, you know? So.
Would there be a good resource that I could look at to kind of read up on both these types of meditation?
Dzogchen Mahamudra?
Yeah.
I think you could find a lot on the internet.
Yeah.
But Tibetan Buddhism has the most kind of mystical, magical type of teachings, and so it's believed that, you know, if you were just to read about these, you'd get some intellectual understanding,
mm-hmm.
but the belief is that to really benefit from them, you'd have to hear them from a trained master,
mm-hmm.
and you would get, they call it a direct mind transmission of the teachings. Just simply reading them, they believe there's very little value in that. You wouldn't get anything out of it.
Sure.
You know, my own feeling is I'm not quite so sure that that's true. That's the belief, you know.
Mm-hmm. So I read an interview that you did with the KC Star a couple years ago. And you also mentioned that when you and your wife first started meditation, you did it for not only spiritual purposes, but for health reasons. And so I was wondering if you could discuss some of the maybe health benefits of meditation.
Yeah, well, what really got me started in meditation, long before I became Buddhist, was I'm 65 years old. So back in the 70s, when I was, like in my 20s, my wife and I both read a book. It's still published. You can find it today. It's called The Relaxation Response by Herbert Benson. And he's a Harvard researcher. He's an MD, The Relaxation Response. Herbert Benson, B-E-N-S-O-N.
Can you respell his last name?
B-E-N-S-O-N.
Got it.
And up until that time, there had been really virtually no research done on the effects of meditation. And at that time, transcendental meditation was really big. And they're still centers today. And they had actually encouraged Benson to study the effects of meditation. And he wasn't too interested in just, you know, one style, which was also kind of commercialized. They charge a lot of money, charge like $1,000, you know, to learn. We charge nothing.
Yeah.
And so he finally decided he would do an experiment and study all the different types of meditation. And so he essentially hooks these subjects up to like a lie detector machine where they measured heart rate, breathing rate, respiration rate, blood pressure, and galvanic skin response. I think I'm leaving one out, but essentially like a lie detector. And what he found, when I tell you this today, it won't be very surprising, but at the time, this discovery was like revolutionary. He found it didn't matter the type of meditation you did. They were all equally effective. He studied, had Zen practitioner, had TM meditation practitioner, self-hypnosis, and there were a couple of others, I don't remember. It didn't matter the type of technique you used. They were all equally effective. All of them lowered respiration, lowered blood pressure, lowered heart rate, smoothed out brain waves. All of them. And up until that time, they didn't know, science didn't know, medicine didn't know, you could control the autonomic nervous system. And today, I mean, that's just, you know, everybody understands that. This was the beginnings of biofeedback, you know. And they thought the mind was separate from the body, and you couldn't control the heart rate, or you couldn't control respiration. Turns out you can. And so Benson's theory was that the reason we have such a high rate of stroke, heart disease in this country is because of the fight or flight response, because most of us are stressed out. We keep eliciting this fight or flight response continually over the day because of our stressful environment. So his hypothesis was, what if we did something that you know, with the fight or flight response, you know, heart rate goes up, blood pressure goes up, respiration goes up, you know, you're in this heightened state of alert. What if you did just the opposite? He called it the relaxation response, with just another name for meditation, which he found out lowered heart rate, lowered respiration, lowered blood pressure. What if you did it on a regular basis? Maybe that would counteract the negative effects of this stress, this fight or flight response. So that was his hypothesis, you know, that maybe that was the cause of heart attack, heart disease, and stroke in this country.
Yeah.
So that was his hypothesis. And I thought, wow, this made a lot of sense. So I started meditating. My wife and I meditated really from a healthful benefit. So that was my first. And when I teach meditation, I still hold up the book. I say, this is my first book. But then later on, there was a teacher by the name of Jon Kabat-Zinn, and he started something called the Stress Reduction Clinic at the Massachusetts Medical Center in Worcester. And his name is spelled, it's J-O-N, and Kabat, K-A-B-O-T, and then hyphen, Z-I-N-N. And that's really his name. So about 30 years ago, maybe, he started this something called this. He's Buddhist. I've seen him at Buddhist conferences. But he thought, what if we introduce this technique of meditation in a very secular sort of way, not mention Buddhism at all. And so he started treating people with panic disorder, with chronic pain, addiction disorder, insomnia. I mean, just on and on and on. And it was a 6-week program at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center. And he had just phenomenal results. And he published dozens of professional articles, the first professional journals. Then he's since retired from there. I think it's still going on, though. He published a book for lay people where he discusses various cases, people who had success, who had chronic pain, who had addiction, who had insomnia. It's called, if you're interested, the book is called Full Catastrophe Living.
Full Catastrophe Living. Living.
Okay. Yeah, good luck spelling catastrophe.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's the other book I usually bring. And so it really documents how successful meditation is in treating some of these ailments. You know?
Okay.
Great.
So stepping back from meditation, just to talk about ritual in general, I'm just curious... when you were developing your practices at the center, like the specific, I guess, prayers that you say for meditation or even your larger Sunday service, how much would you say, let's say authentically Tibetan, you know, if that's the right word to use, and how much would you say you've had to adapt and modify traditions that you learned to fit more of a Western audience, I guess?
Well, first of all, in Tibet, you know, the main practice across America, Americans who practice Buddhism, is meditation,
mm-hmm.
right?
Sure.
But if you go to India or Tibet and you watch Tibetans, lay Tibetans don't meditate. That's not their practice. They do something called circumambulation. They walk clockwise and they have a prayer beads and they're saying the mantra of compassion, Om Mani Padme Hum. They walk clockwise around, it could be a temple, it could be a stupa, or even the Dalai Lama's residence.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's spiritual, but also I think it has a slight social aspect to it, because especially older Tibetans, you don't see too many younger Tibetans doing this, but they do it in the morning and they do it in the evening. So you see them doing this. It's called kora. Kora means going around, circumambulating, always clockwise. They don't meditate. Monks do some meditation, but that's not really, you know, if you're asking how authentic it is, you know, lay Tibetans don't meditate.
Sure.
Monks meditate somewhat, but they do other practices as well.
Mm-hmm.
Our Sunday service, when I was with the Shambhala group, they would have on Sunday 3 hours of sitting from 9 until noon. You could come for part of it, you could come for all of it, you could come and go. There was no chanting, there was no Dharma talk, there was just 3 hours of sitting. So when we moved into this building, I said, I want to have a service that Westerners can relate to. So that what we created is our own thing. You know, you go into any other Buddhist center, you won't find it. You know? So we came up with this. I feel it keeps some of the Tibetan tradition authentic, mm-hmm. but then we introduce aspects that are very, very Western Tibetan, you know, you wouldn't see over in Tibet or Nepal, India. So for example, we sing several of the mantras we put to song, mm-hmm. you can probably experience.
Yeah.
Green Tara and Chimrizi. So that's, and I intentionally did that to raise the comfort level for Westerners. So mm-hmm. this is, I went to church, we sing hymns, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's the service, printed service, which is, you know, it's similar in some aspects to a service at church, you know. And then at the end, I give a Dharma talk, the equivalent of a sermon.
Mm-hmm.
So it's completely, totally, just put, you know, creative,
mm-hmm.
created.
Are the what about the mantras? Like the mantras themselves?
Well, the mantras are authentic.
Uh-huh.
Yes, absolutely.
And so those all kind of have sources in Tibetan tradition and whatnot.
Yeah. And these chants or prayers that we do supplication to Manjushri, supplication to Tara, supplication to, you know, all these supplications to the various, they're called bodhisattvas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those are authentic.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Interesting.
So there are parts that, you know, are very authentic. There are parts of it that are very Western that we added.
Yeah.
And you go to another Western Buddhist center, you just, I mean, people think, oh, this is what you do. If I go over here, I'll find the same thing. You know?
No. Sure. I imagine that was part of the decision to have a Sunday service.
Well,
because
you know, if you're Jewish, it's a Saturday, right? If you're Islam, it's Friday. But Christians go to church on Sunday. That's what I was raised in, so I was used to going to church on Sunday. And it has no special significance to Buddhists,
right?
So I pick Sunday.
Society kind of structured itself around that anyway, you know, yeah. Making Sunday the day, I suppose.
And I made it 10:30, because I'm not an early morning person. I did it as late as possible, so that we could still end by noon. You know?
Yeah.
And there, you know, many churches, I was down at the Community Christian, Bob Hills Church, the one on the plaza, the Frank Lloyd Wright building, you know, mm-hmm. and he and most other churches, they have like 2, 3, 4 services on Sunday. It just like blows my mind. I can't imagine doing more than one service.
Yeah. Yeah. Just because I want to get record of it, so I think I've heard the story before, but part of the service is that you wear the red and the white garments.
Who? The lay people?
No, you do.
I do.
You yeah. do, yes. You wear the red and the white garments. I was wondering if you could talk about what's the significance of the garments, specifically the color white.
Well, you're wearing a maroon
T-shirt,
and that's almost the color that monks and nuns and lamas wear, this maroon color.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. I don't wear much white. Why did you ask about white?
There's a white element that you throw over.
Yeah, there's a shawl called a zen, and the one that I wear is maroon and white striped.
Yes.
And that indicates that I'm a layperson.
Okay.
The lama could be a monk, a monastic, which means they're celibate.
Uh-huh.
Or a lama could be a layperson, could be married like I am. So the zen that I wear is maroon and white stripe.
Mm-hmm.
Means I'm a layperson. If it was solid maroon, it would indicate I'm a monastic, I'm a monk.
Okay.
So that's the difference.
Okay, so the white stripe's just in. Okay, yes.
That makes sense.
Okay, so I was wondering if you could discuss the relationship that you had with the Rime Center to other, specifically non-Buddhist organizations
such
in the region. Well, I'm thinking mostly popular Christian groups and whatnot. Have you had much of an interaction with the local religious community, like working together, or has there ever been any sort of... I remember a couple years ago there was actually an issue with, there was a Lao Buddhist temple that wanted to get built in Olathe, and there was a pushback.
I was very involved with that.
Sure.
I became their media spokesman.
Sure.
None of them spoke English.
Yeah. So I was wondering if you could talk about the relationship that the Rime Center itself has had with the local community.
I like to be involved in interfaith things. I've been a member of the Interfaith Council in Kansas City for 20 years. I've been the Buddhist representative, and I think interfaith dialogue is just critically important. So that's one of the things I really enjoy doing. But also, I have very good friends who are ministers in other churches, like Bob Hill. Last night I was at a meeting, something they're planning in the fall, and there was Marvin Schneller, who's with the Jewish Community Relations Board. I was Buddhist, but people from different traditions. So, yes. And then our really big annual event is called the Meditation for World Peace that we've been doing for 15 years. It's itself is about 30 years old, but we picked it up in 2000 when nobody was... It almost had died, and it's truly an interfaith event. It's not just a Buddhist event.
Mm-hmm.
So we have the 15, 16 members of the Interfaith Council who give prayers of peace from each faith tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Pardon me. We have an African-American woman named Queen Mother who sings, leads us in song. It's just very much interfaith. There's very little Buddhist about it. We invite people of other faiths, other traditions.
Great. Do you have much interaction with the local Buddhist community, like other Buddhist organizations?
Well, I think we have good relationships with them. There's on the plaza, there's Unity, has several, I call them special interest groups that meet on different nights of the week. There's a Zen group that meets one night. There's a Thich Nhat Hanh group that meets another night. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And Janet Taylor, who's changed her name to Nima, is sort of the director of that. I think she has a ministerial degree from Unity, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Duke Tufte is the main minister, but she's like a co-minister. Kind of oversees that. Then there are three what I call ethnic Buddhist centers in Kansas City. There's that Laotian one that you talk about in Olathe. you know, not only is their whole service in Laotian, but very, almost none of them speak English, you know. Mm-hmm. So I became their spokesman when they were trying to get a some land zoned for a new building. There's a Chinese group or temple. They meet in a house in Leewood. From the outside, you would never know that it's a temple. Just it's a big house on off of 103rd.
And that's a Chinese.
Chinese. So we have Laotian, we have Chinese, and the third.
Sorry, so write this down.
Sure. Third one is there's a very large Vietnamese temple north of the river. And we've had a really good relationship with them over the years. Again, the monk, who's sort of the resident monk there, doesn't speak English. So that's always the challenge. And they each of these do their service in Chinese, in Laotian, or in Vietnamese language.
Okay.
So Westerners are certainly welcome, but it's kind of a challenge, you know, because you have no idea.
Sure. Sure, and those... And so those groups developed mostly out of, like, first-generation immigrants coming over and starting these communities.
I would think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Great.
Let's see. I have one more question.
Okay.
Which is, wondering if you could just, what's it like being a Buddhist in Kansas? Just a simple, I mean...
I don't think it's any different than than being a Jew or a Christian.
Sure.
I don't think.
Yeah.
People often ask if I've ever felt discriminated against, and I have to say, no, I haven't. I get some strange looks when I'm out in my llama robe. Mm-hmm. And the funniest situation was a number of years ago, we had a visiting teacher, and I was picking up some text that he needed for his teachings. And I was at Kinko's stand. It happened to be Halloween. It was October 31st. I'm standing at the counter, and this woman looked at me. She looked up. She looked at me. She said, "Great costume." And I said, "Yeah, and it fits so well too." You know?
Well, it's great.
But yeah, I don't feel that my life is much different.
Well, cool. Well, great. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Cool.